Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, December 13th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, MDC approves entertainment center. Project, which now goes to City Council, will consist of a cinema, event stage, and more. By Mella McEwen. Members of the Board of Directors of the Midland Development Corporation unanimously, with one abstention, lit the green light propelling development of an entertainment center in West Midland. Board members approved a letter of intent between the MDC, City of Midland, and Hodges Development Services, LP, for the project. Members of the City Council will now take up the proposal at its meeting Tuesday. If and when the City Council approves the letter, we can negotiate the final agreement, however long that takes, 30 to 60 days or longer, said Stephen Lowry, board chairman. He called the vote the green light to get the project moving forward seriously. Though the letter of intent is non-binding, Lowry said the intent was to outline the project so we don't have to come back and renegotiate. I'm comfortable with this, he said. The parameters of the proposal had been approved verbally by all parties, noted MDC Executive Director Sarah Harris. The project will consist of a lot for a 60,000-square-foot family cinema and entertainment center, complete with an outdoor music and event stage, a 60,000-square-foot lot to be occupied by a nationally recognized retailer, and platted lots for other general retailers and restaurants. Non-disclosure agreements prevent the disclosure of the specific names involved in the development. The agreement between Hodges, the MDC, and City of Midland calls for construction to begin by September 1, 2023, with completion no later than January 1, 2027. Lowry said that with full approval of the letter of intent and negotiations toward a final agreement set to begin, there will be lots of paperwork to read in the coming weeks. Hodges will invest $45 million in the project, and MDC is being asked to contribute $5 million to fund the roads and other infrastructure. Harris said those new roads will become city roads once complete. The letter of intent includes city property tax abatements over a period of 10 years, dropping from 100% the first 2 years to 20% in the final 2 years. It also includes a city sales tax rebate of 50% generated by the cinema and entertainment center and the retailer, as well as the general retailers and restaurants for the first 7 years they are open to the public. This article is entitled, County Leaders Approve Resolution to Protect Unborn. Decision passes 4-1. Sole opponent says issue falls outside county's powers. By Ben Schaffer. The Midland County Commissioners Court passed a resolution, 4-1, establishing Midland County to protect life from conception to natural death Monday morning. A large crowd of Midlanders gathered in the county courthouse to hear the decision. County Judge Terry Johnson said he supports Governor Greg Abbott's measures and, as a community, owe the passing of the resolution to protect the unborn. Johnson had sent a copy of the resolution this weekend to at least one pro-life group, which called for its members to attend the meeting to support the court. Precinct 4 Commissioner Randy Prude called for a motion to pass the resolution. Prude was strongly in favor of passing the resolution and urged pro-choice advocates to view a film called The Silent Scream, which includes an uncensored abortion operation. He said if all people were required to watch the procedure happen live, The industry would shut down tomorrow. He added, "There are people in this world who find themselves in deep, deep trouble with an unwanted pregnancy. There are equal numbers of people, in my opinion, who would do anything within their power, including give money, adopt, and so forth, to save any child." The lone commissioner to vote against the resolution was Scott Ramsey. He remarked that the state legislature has clearly outlined the duty of county government, and resolutions about abortion do not fit under Midland County's spectrum of responsibility. This agenda item puts one of the most controversial and hotly debated topics at the foot of the commissioner's court, Ramsey said, which begs the question, why? Ramsey questioned the purpose of the resolution and said, out of all the discussions he's had regarding the topic, nobody can answer why this is being dealt with at the county level. He attempted to table the discussion, but his motion did not receive a second. "The county has no powers with regard to this topic," Ramsey said. "We should leave this to the state and federal elected officials that do have powers to resolve the issue." Precinct 2 Commissioner Robin Donnelly said that at a personal level he agreed with the resolution, but concurred with Commissioner Ramsey. "How does the county, within its functions, do something that is proactive rather than just make a resolution?" he said. Donnelly ended up voting for the resolution. Lastly, the court's lone Democrat voted for the resolution. Precinct 3 Commissioner Luis Sanchez claimed he believes in protecting life, but said ending the death penalty and expanding Medicaid should be considered as well. "What I would like to see on here as well is getting rid of the death penalty. If we're going to talk about conception to natural death, that's something I'd like to see," he said. "Medicaid expansion will create a better life for the children saved through pro-life measures," according to Sanchez. Midland Democratic Party Chair Kathy Broderick was the only speaker during a public comment period to urge the court to vote against the resolution and questioned its purpose. "We all know there is no legal abortion in Texas, and certainly not in Midland. It's about helping people who travel out of the area to get health care. Are you going to start prosecuting people who help others leave the county to go to Albuquerque?" she asked. She wondered what the county will gain from passing the resolution. Midlander Mike Banchback of Pro-Life Midland said Governor Abbott and state legislators have already committed large sums of money to assist women with unwanted or unplanned pregnancies with the Alternatives to Abortion program. He removed religion from his speech and shifted his focus to science. "At the moment of conception, the fetus has a different DNA configuration than the mother," according to Banchback. "Additionally, cardiac tissue starts to pulse at around 5 weeks of pregnancy, and by week 10, the first electrical brain activity begins," he said. "At what point does irreversible, constantly changing growth of a living entity really start? If we're going to be scientifically honest, we have to say that that's the moment of conception," he said. Pastor Roy Smith from True Light Christian Fellowship said it is solely God's decision to end or create life. "We cannot separate our Christianity and who we are from our acts, our actions, our choices. Those things make up the principles by which we live," he said. This article is entitled "Oil Wells Creeping into Texas Cities Herald Shale Era's Twilight." Analysts say Permian Basin's output could plateau within 5 years. By David Weth and Kevin Crowley, Bloomberg. Each morning when Michael Quinn pulls into the parking lot of the luxury apartment complex he manages in West Texas and looks across the street, an unsightly vision blots the horizon, a 24-foot-high insulated wall. Quinn, who works at the Midway Station Apartments in Midland, isn't troubled by the eyesore. The barrier, covered in a sand-colored tarp, is designed to muffle noise from an oil well site across the road. To Quinn, it's a symbol of a flourishing industry that's the lifeblood of the local economy. But it actually tells a very different story. The wall, and an accompanying surge in urban drilling, is the latest sign that America's shale fields are reaching middle age. An uptick in drilling within the city limits signals that the very best rock in one of the world's most prolific oil fields has already been tapped. In the shale boom's early days, with so much crude-soaked land up for grabs elsewhere in the Permian Basin, there was little reason to deal with the red tape needed to bore underneath populated areas. But with over two-thirds of the Permian's premium land now drilled, according to BMO Capital Markets, producers are seeking more permits than ever to burrow beneath Midland and its 130,000 residents. Observers have long been predicting shale's demise or heralding its rebirth. But this time is different. After years of honing their craft to boost output, producers in the Permian's two main zones are pumping less oil per foot drilled in each new well, not more. Output guidance from ExxonMobil Corporation, Chevron Corporation, and Devon Energy Corporation has shown that U.S. shale growth is coming in at the low end of expectations. Analysts say the Permian could reach a production plateau within 5 years. That's a problem that reaches far beyond Texas. U.S. shale, led by the Permian, has provided 90% of global oil output growth in the past decade, according to research firm Enverus. It made the U.S. the biggest producer, ahead of Saudi Arabia. A shale slowdown means the world can no longer rely on the U.S. to be its swing oil supplier, capable of ramping up or down quickly to temper a volatile market. It complicates the Biden administration's efforts to tame pump prices, and it hands more power back to OPEC as Russia's invasion of Ukraine upends oil and gas supply. U.S. supply is already materially slowing down, said Francisco Blanche, head of commodities research at Bank of America Corporation. It's giving OPEC a lot of comfort to come in and keep prices elevated because they don't fear U.S. shale like they did in the past. The Permian Basin sprang into the public consciousness about a decade ago as new fracking techniques transformed what was thought to be a depleted oil field into some of the most desirable acreage on the planet. Crucially, U.S. shale's spectacular growth, adding more crude to global markets from 2012 to 2020 than the entire current production of Iraq and Iran combined, became a thorn in the eye of OPEC, which saw its market dominance threatened like never before. But U.S. output tumbled at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic and is still about 1 million barrels a day below the record 13 million reached in early 2020. Next year, growth is likely to be around 560,000 barrels a day, according to Enverus. That's despite crude prices averaging more than $90 a barrel this year, far above what producers need to break even. Skyrocketing costs for labor and equipment, as well as pressure to return more cash to shareholders, are partly to blame for drillers' restraint. Rising interest rates, meanwhile, likely herald the end of cheap money for shale producers looking to finance even modest growth plans. But a new, more troubling trend has emerged in recent weeks. The rock itself is yielding less oil. Wells drilled this year produced between 8% and 13% less oil per lateral foot than a year earlier, according to Bloomberg NEF, the first major reversal after a decade of productivity gains. Pioneer Natural Resources Company, one of the biggest Permian operators, recently overhauled its drilling plan after executives were not satisfied with its well performance this year. Laredo Petroleum Inc. said some of its production was hurt by interference from other wells nearby. A higher proportion of drilling is now done by private companies, which aren't beholden to shareholder pressure to boost buybacks and dividends. But that's contributing to lower productivity, according to Philip Jungwirth, an analyst at BMO Capital Markets. Private producers tend to have less desirable acreage, he said. Some public and private companies are using a method known as multi-zone development, which means they're drilling several layers of shale at once to improve efficiency. But in doing so, they're also tapping their less productive rock. BMO estimates that most of the top-tier land has already been developed in the Permian and in the Bakken of North Dakota, the top-producing shale regions. That leaves explorers with a lower inventory of the most valuable yet-to-be-drilled sites. "We're going to run out of inventory in the next 4 to 6 years," said James West, an analyst at Evercore ISI. "We probably saw it earlier in other shales, which is why we left those other shales and moved so much activity to the Permian. It's now rearing its ugly head in the Permian." Midland, the largest town in the Permian, has fielded 100 applications so far this year to drill within city limits, said Ron Jenkins, the city's oil and gas coordinator. That's nearly double last year's total, and the highest since Midland instituted a city ordinance for in-town drilling in 2010. Though the Permian is running out of premium rock, it isn't grinding to a halt by any stretch. Production there is expected to keep growing for at least the next few years, although at a more measured pace compared with the height of the shale boom. To gain an advantage, some large publicly traded U.S. producers have made acquisitions in a bid to boost their access to top-tier acreage. The forward-thinking companies are getting additional acreage to complement their plays as strategically as possible, said Sarah Harris, executive director of Midland Development Corporation, the city's economic development arm. But she cautioned, too many people have wrongly called the death knell for the Permian over the years. Then, with new technologies, it turned out there were a lot more resources to be had. Economic woes around the world have helped push oil prices lower in recent weeks. But if the Permian Basin's growing pains continue, then the world oil market could lose its biggest growth engine, putting power back in the hands of OPEC and Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. "The Saudis and OPEC have waited this out," said John Hess, chief executive officer at Hess Corporation, which drills in the Bakken. "Now, really OPEC is back in the driver's seat." This article is entitled, "Light for Uganda Makes Difference at Overseas Orphanage," by Gloria Youngblood, contributor. Editor's note, this article from Light for Uganda is another in the series from a local nonprofit highlighting its service during the giving season. If your organization has a message to send out to Reporter Telegram readers during the month of December, please send it to sdoreen@hearstnp.com. Light for Uganda was started as a nonprofit 501c3 charity through Texas Arms of Love in 2013, as a result of a Midland couple's connection to Uganda. Wilton and Gloria Youngblood began going to Uganda on mission trips in 1997. On one of those trips in 2004, a divine connection caused them to concentrate their efforts in Fort Portal, working with churches in the area. In 2020, Light for Uganda opened up King's Kids Orphanage and City Hills School. Several Midlanders have participated in these trips, including a medical group which now goes frequently to provide life-saving health care for the area residents. Our board is composed of Midlanders who contribute to the community through work and volunteerism in other areas as well. A mission team led by the Youngbloods went to Fort Portal this past July to dedicate the orphanage and to work with church leaders from Western Uganda. The pastor in Fort Portal, Moses Mujuguzi, is director of the orphanage and travels to Midland regularly, preaching in churches and bringing reports. The operation of the orphanage, which is home to 110 orphans, is funded in two ways. By day-only City Hill students paying small tuitions, and by donations. Because Uganda is one of the poorest nations in the world, most families cannot afford to send their children to school. Unfortunately, worldwide inflation has now made it even more difficult. Those who began paying in 2020 have had to make tough decisions between school or food. This has therefore caused a reduction in finances coming in, which has created a challenge with the orphanage. A few months ago, it caused a food shortage at the orphanage, as well as a lack of staff salaries. At best, the orphaned youth, ages 12 to 17, get a meal of cornmeal porridge, a filler called cassava, and beans. Only when someone donates a special meal do they get meat or fruits. We invite people to partner with us by going with us on a mission trip and or by giving a single donation or a monthly donation to sponsor an orphan. On the giving page are ways to give through credit cards or checks. Donors' names will be placed at the orphanage, and you could choose to give in honor of a person's birthday, anniversary, holiday, or in memory of someone. A note will be sent to the address you provide. Please visit the website lightforuganda.org. Visit all of the pages, listen to the short video, and decide if you can help in any way. God will supply, as He shows individuals, if they are the ones to participate in this vision. While you get a lot of requests from charitable organizations, we hope that you might see this opportunity differently at this critical time for the orphanage. As you consider this, remember the well-known story by Lauren Isley to explain your impact on one life through a donation. A boy was throwing starfish back into the ocean after they washed ashore. A man who was watching him asked him, "Why are you doing that? There are more starfish than you can ever save." "You can't make a difference." "I can make a difference to this one," the boy said, as he threw yet another one into the ocean. If you have any questions, feel free to call, text Gloria at 432-413-9849 or email her at WILTGLO@att.net. This article is called Area Roundup, and it is from the Midland Reporter Telegram. It is entitled, DPS, 15-year-old driver dies in accident near Gardendale. A 15-year-old boy died Friday morning after a wreck east of Gardendale, according to the Department of Public Safety. The 15-year-old was driving a 2003 Dodge Ram east of Cottonwood Road in a construction zone when the vehicle veered off the roadway, according to DPS. The Dodge truck then continued into a field and rolled over. DPS did not release the name of the minor. Troopers did report that he was not wearing a seatbelt. The report also stated that the accident happened around 7 a.m., less than 1 mile east of Gardendale. This story is entitled DPS, Odessan Dies in Two-Vehicle Collision. A 78-year-old Odessa man died Friday morning after the vehicle he was driving was struck on U.S. Highway 385 south of Odessa, according to the Department of Public Safety. DPS reported that Isidro Hinojosa Minjares was exiting the Dollar General parking lot in his 2002 Ford F-150 and was crossing the northbound lanes of U.S. 385 when a 1997 Ford F-250 traveling north struck Hinojosa Minjares' vehicle. Hinojosa Minjares was not wearing a seatbelt, according to DPS, which also reported that the accident took place around 9 a.m., 4 miles south of Odessa. This column is called Commentary. It is entitled, Corporate Welfare is a Hard Reality of Living in Midland, by Stuart Doreen, Midland Reporter Telegram editor. If we want cool stuff in Midland, it will come at a cost, sometimes to the taxpayer. We found that out again with the Reporter-Telegram report Friday that the Midland Development Corporation, the City of Midland, and Hodges Development Services are working on a deal that could bring a 60,000-square-foot entertainment facility to West Midland. The specific location will be the area around where Costco was looking to build a Midland location before canceling the project. But it will come at a cost, as most cool things do. As Mella McEwen reported Friday, a deal would include $5 million in MDC funds for road and infrastructure improvements and property tax abatements and sales tax rebates. What will that mean? The City of Midland is providing corporate welfare when one would think coming to Midland should be good enough. Over the years, we have seen this play out with Midland Development Corporation incentives, including to oil companies. We have given out city dollars, including in the building of a baseball stadium, cheap rent, and exclusivity of facility use to the Midland Rockhounds to keep AA baseball in Midland. We handed out millions of dollars in benefits for downtown development, retail providers, airport, spaceport development, and others looking to do business in Midland. Our leaders vote to hand out dollars because convincing arguments are made that if the city doesn't spend that money, a business might leave or won't come to Midland. Corporate welfare has happened for decades. At first, we were told if Midland isn't willing to dole out the funds, someone else will. Now, we hear there is a Midland markup. The cost of land is so great here. Inflation is as great inside Midland as any other metropolitan area in the regional Southwest. But in the end, we know companies go around asking because they know they will get something to make their time worthwhile. What will be the total investment that the city is making here, in addition to the $5 million in road and infrastructure improvements? Don't know. But this has the potential to be a massive project with a 60,000-square-foot family cinema and entertainment center, complete with an outdoor music and event stage, a 60,000-square-foot lot to be occupied by a nationally recognized retailer, and platted lots for other general retailers and restaurants. McEwen also reports the agreement between Hodges, the MDC, and City of Midland calls for private investments of $45 million and construction to begin by September 1, 2023, with completion no later than January 1, 2027. By contrast, Synergy Cinemas Midland LP pays an estimated $150,000 in property taxes for its facilities and other property at its 52,455-square-foot facility in Southwest Midland. The estimated valuation for the property is around $10 million. This article isn't to say city leaders have or are making a bad deal when it comes to these corporate handouts. Midland voters approved the quarter-cent sales tax increase in 2001, knowing that funds would be provided for corporate assistance. And in the past 20-plus years, there hasn't been a city leader voted out for decisions to give money to corporations like the one looking to build the entertainment center in West Midland. These deals are just part of the reality of living in Midland. I don't have to like it. I have just come to accept it. At some point, we will celebrate the opening of any entertainment center that will give Midlanders more to do. After it's open, hopefully we will say it was worth the cost. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled "Keystone Has the U.S.'s Most Oil Spills" by Robert Tuttle, Bloomberg. Last week's oil spill in Kansas means that TC Energy Corporation's Keystone Pipeline has now leaked more crude oil than any other conduit on U.S. land in the past 12 years. The major line running from Canada into the U.S. Midwest was shut after a spill of 14,000 barrels, with some of that crude released into a local waterway. The spill, in combination with several others in recent years, will mean that Keystone has leaked almost 26,000 barrels of crude on U.S. land since 2010. That's the most of any other pipeline during that period, according to preliminary spill data from the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. Other notable pipeline spills include Tesoro's High Plains conduit that ruptured in 2013 and Enbridge Inc.'s Line 6B, which caused a massive oil leak in the Kalamazoo River in 2010, the data shows. The 2010 BP oil spill that spewed millions of barrels of crude took place after an offshore drill rig sank in the Gulf of Mexico. Over the last several years, we have taken decisive action to implement measures to strengthen our approach to safety and the integrity of our system, and will conduct a full investigation into the root cause of this incident, in cooperation with regulators, the company said in a statement. So far, TC Energy hasn't submitted a plan to restart the 600,000-barrel-a-day pipeline, PHMSA said in a statement. The company is excavating the area of the spill to inspect damage to the line, according to Randy Hubbard, the county's emergency management coordinator. While Keystone is the largest spiller of crude oil since 2010, the refined fuel pipeline Colonial Pipeline's Line 1 has spilled more liquid hydrocarbons than Keystone. This article is entitled "New Mexico State Government Reaps Budget Boom from Oil" by Morgan Lee, Associated Press. Santa Fe, New Mexico. The state of New Mexico is likely to inherit a new multi-billion dollar financial windfall, largely from surging oil production and robust energy prices in the era of war between Ukraine and Russia, economists told a panel of leading legislators on Monday. Economists from four state agencies revised upward estimates of government income that are the basis for budget negotiations by lawmakers when the legislature convenes in January 2023. They estimate state government income of nearly $12 billion for the fiscal year running from July 2023 to June 2024. That revenue would exceed current annual general fund spending obligations by $3.6 billion, or 43%. The forecast enhances the potential spending authority of newly re-elected Democratic Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham and members of the Democratic-led legislature. Democratic State Senator George Munoz of Gallup said the state has a unique opportunity to make investments that expand economic opportunity and rein in dependence on petroleum production in the future. No one in this state's history has ever had this opportunity, said Munoz, vice chairman of the legislator's lead budget writing committee. We can really set this state up to not be dependent on oil and gas. He also highlighted efforts to improve public education in the aftermath of the COVID-19 pandemic and aggressive health restrictions that shut down classroom teaching for roughly a year. Lujan Grisham last week outlined new goals for combating childhood poverty by expanding daycare subsidies and providing meals at schools free of charge. Her administration also is proposing an expansion of minimum instructional time at schools and increases in school salaries and benefits. Public schools in New Mexico operate primarily on money from the state general fund and investment income from New Mexico's $26 billion land grant permanent fund. Voters in November approved an increase in annual withdrawals from the land grant trust to boost spending on K-12 schools and early childhood education, though congressional approval is still required and pending. If Monday's state income forecast comes to fruition, billions of dollars will automatically flow to a new investment fund designed to underwrite early childhood education initiatives. The balance could reach $8 billion as soon as 2024. Money is pouring into government accounts from a variety of taxes and fees. Much of it can be traced to oil and natural gas development in New Mexico's portion of the Permian Basin that stretches across the southeast corner of the state and western Texas. New Mexico in 2021 became the number two oil producer in the nation behind Texas and continued to set local production records as recently as September. The legislature's Budget and Accountability Office said state government is relying increasingly on income from the fossil fuel industry that could falter suddenly with an economic turndown. Oil production has expanded far beyond pre-pandemic levels and shifted toward public lands overseen by the U.S. government, providing New Mexico with a boost in royalty payments to its state general fund. It's really staggering, said Ismael Torres, chief economist at the Budget and Accountability Office. You can see that New Mexico is really powering the U.S. oil production growth. Department of Finance and Administration Secretary Deborah Romero, who retires later this month without a named replacement, encouraged legislators to consider one-time investments in infrastructure for water and communications and cautioned against expanding permanent programs too much. This article is entitled "Growing Popularity of Trucks Dents Fuel Economy Gains," by Dana Hull, Bloomberg. The rising popularity of large trucks and sport utility vehicles is slowing the auto industry's efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, the U.S. government found. After reaching a record high in 2020, fuel economy for vehicles from the last model year was unchanged, according to a report released Monday from the Environmental Protection Agency. Carbon dioxide emissions decreased slightly in 2021, the study found. The figures reflect consumers' embrace of larger, heavier, and more powerful vehicles, which typically have lower fuel economy and higher CO2 emissions than other automobiles. Sedans fell to 26% of the cars produced in 2021, down from more than 80% in 1975, the report found. The large vehicles that the EPA calls truck SUVs reached a record high of 45% of production. This is the obituary column, Tuesday, December 13th. James Thomas Newton, Jr. was a son, brother, uncle, cousin, husband, father, and grandfather. All of these things he did to the fullest until the end. The family will greet friends from 6 to 8 p.m. Tuesday, December 13th at Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home. A funeral service will be held at 2 p.m. Wednesday, December 14th at Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home Chapel. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Walker E. and Joyce Montgomery. W. E. Montgomery, 85, and Joyce Montgomery, 84, of Louisville, formerly of Midland, passed away November 9th and November 29th, surrounded by loving family, dear friends, beloved dog, and compassionate caregivers that stayed by their side. W.E. was born to Adar Baird, A.B., and Desi Montgomery on July 27, 1937, in Midland. Joyce Linville Montgomery was born on January 11, 1938, to James and Elsie Linville in San Augustine, Texas. Survived by three adoring children, Lisa Gandy, late husband Steve, Adam Montgomery, Maria, and Mona Thompson, Mike, as well as nine grandchildren and six great-grandchildren. Graveside services for Walker and Joyce, under the direction of Ellis Rest Haven Funeral Home, will be Saturday, December 17th at 1 p.m. at Rest Haven Cemetery. Donations may be made to Access Life, which bridges the gap between individuals and families affected by disabilities. www.access-life.org or Access.Life Inc., P.O. Box 99, Altoona, Florida, 32702. Death Notices. Fred Leggett. Fred Leggett, 83, of Midland, passed away Friday, December 9th. A memorial will be held Friday, December 16th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at the branch at NPW. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Joy Allison Johnson Balling. Joy Allison Johnson Balling, 82, passed away December 6th. A funeral service will be held at Acres West Funeral Chapel in Odessa at 1 p.m. on Wednesday, December 14th. Burial follows at Serenity Memorial Garden Cemetery in Midland. Joy is survived by two daughters, Kathy Tillman and Tristy Browning, as well as two stepdaughters, Loana Pearson and Sherry Van Denberg, and four siblings. Tommy Hudson. Tommy Glenn Hudson, 77, of Midland, passed away on Thursday, December 8th. Visitation is Thursday, December 15th, from 2 p.m. to 7 p.m. at Jackie Warren Funeral Home. Services will be held Friday, December 16th at 11 a.m. at Macedonia Baptist Church.
Good morning, this is Kim, and I'm reading the Odessa American. Today's date is Tuesday, December 13th. ECISD Board to hire new police chief. With the retirement of Ector County ISD Police Chief Todd Heiner, the board will consider hiring a new police chief at their 6 p.m. meeting today, December 13th. The meeting will be in the first floor boardroom of the administration building, 802 North Sam Houston Avenue. Heiner has been police chief for about 8 years. He plans to go full-time in his pest control business. Chief Pest Control and enjoy his children and grandchildren. Candidates include Jerry Daniels, assistant chief for ECISD, Arturo Fuentes, city manager for City of Sonora, Dr. Paul Lilly, County Judge for Brown County, and Kobe Faust, Police Sergeant for University of Texas, Permian Basin. The board will also have a public hearing on Amendment Number 1 to Agreement for Limitation on Appraised Value between the District and Nacero, Texas 1, LLC, Texas Comptroller Application Number 1568, pursuant to Chapter 313 of the Texas Tax Code. According to the Texas Comptroller's website, an appraised value limitation is an agreement in which a taxpayer agrees to build or install property and create jobs in exchange for a 10-year limitation on the taxable property value for school district maintenance and operation tax, M&O, purposes. The minimum limitation value varies by school district. The application for a limitation on the appraised value for M&O purposes is submitted directly to the school district and requires an application fee that is established by each school district, the site said. Under special recognitions, the meeting will include the introduction of trustees' Christmas card student designers, recognition of Harris Sewell, All-American Game invitee, announcement of Crime Stoppers State Director Award, and recognition of National Board of Professional Teaching Standards honoree. Mary Mojo, Panther Paws donate to communities in schools. Every year, Permian High School's Panther Paws dance team contributes to a cause around Christmas time. This year, the recipient is Communities in Schools on Campus. 33 varsity and JV dancers bought in dozens of items, each with coats and hairbrushes to feminine hygiene products. Assistant coach Kayla Garza said they recently heard from the Pink Pantry, a partnership between Communities in Schools and the Junior League of Odessa, to provide free feminine hygiene products to girls. We talked to Communities in Schools, and they told us what was in need, and so we asked our girls to bring at least 5 items, but a lot of them brought like 20 to 25 items. It was awesome, Garza said. Garza and the Panther Paws coach, Kristen Carter, went to the Mary Marketplace and heard a presentation about Pink Pantry. That's when we realized that it was within Permian High School, and that's when I reached out to Communities and Schools here to find out more information, Garza said. In previous years, the Panther Paws have contributed to the Humane Society, West Texas Food Bank, Permian Basin Rehabilitation Center, Angel House and Jesus House, and more. In Adelia Urita, Communities in Schools coordinator for PHS, said it is a mentoring and advocacy program. We've heard it all, seen it all, so nothing is too big or too small. We tried to tackle everything, Urita said. CIS is also in the middle and elementary schools. Urita spoke to the Panther Paws after they dropped their contributions in the CIS office. I'm very overwhelmed because this was a lot of stuff, and you guys have a very big heart, and we thank you and appreciate you for helping, because sometimes you just don't know what another student is carrying who walks right beside you each day in these halls, Urita said. Jaden Dansby, an 18-year-old senior, and Amaris Ramirez, a 17-year-old senior, have both been on Panther Paws for 4 years. I think it was important because I feel like other people need this, and it's important to take care of other people and support them with everything they need. We love helping out and supporting one another, Dansby said. Ramirez said it was heartwarming to give back to the school in this way. We do a lot for our school, so we're very supportive of it. I'm excited that we're able to be part of it, Ramirez added. She said the supplies are important, especially for the people they don't know that need the items. You never know who's going through something. So I think it's very important for us to give out as much as we can to help, Ramirez said. Asked if she was surprised at how large the donation became, Ramirez said if they need something, they are usually going to go over the top to give as much as they need to. Yurita said they contributed jackets, coats, leggings, pants, hygiene products, hoodies, and undergarments. Garza said there are quite a few students in school who don't know that there are people in need. I think it's really beneficial for our girls to know that there are people walking next to them that are in need and that they can do something as little as buying a travel size of shampoo, and that means the world to somebody else, she said. Regional laundry fills a need. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes work that goes on at hospitals, and some of it is laundry. About 12 years ago, Texas Healthcare Linen was formed in Abilene to handle laundry from local and regional hospitals. The original owners were Medical Center Hospital, Midland Memorial Hospital, and Hendrick Health in Abilene. Shannon Hospital in San Angelo was added as an owner last year. Joe Max Tomlin is the general manager of Texas Healthcare Linen. THL serves about 75 facilities within a 200-mile radius of Abilene, pretty much every large facility. We go all the way to Lubbock, San Angelo, we go to Dallas, Fort Worth, and then Odessa is as far west as we go, Tomlin said in a phone interview. About 15 million pounds of linen go through the facility every year, including 1.5 million pounds a year from Medical Center. We have our trucks and we pick up soiled linen and deliver clean linen every day. It just kind of depends on the size of the facility, on how often we come. For example, Medical Center Hospital, we're 5 days a week, but a small clinic, we might only be 1 day a week, Tomlin said. Their best reference is usually word of mouth from other hospitals, but we do have a customer service manager and myself that try to develop leads. Generally, linen services are contracted for 3 to 5 years, so we just try to discover hospitals, preferably the larger hospitals. We try to find out about their contract expiration and start contacting them to develop a relationship. If it's a good fit for us and for them, hopefully we can work out a deal, Tomlin said. The profit margin for the laundry are typically small. Our goal is to provide savings to our owners, so we're kind of a unique laundry facility from the standpoint of we are owned by 4 hospitals and then all of the other facilities that are our customers are profit customers. But our goal is to help our owners save while providing them a great service, Tomlin said. Our bottom line isn't necessarily our focus as much as making sure we have cash flow so we can operate the business and then providing a great service to our owners, he added. TLC has 88 employees, depending on the day. Drivers travel 1,000 plus miles per day. That's all combined. We have 9 drivers with 8 different trucks, so 1 driver will run a route, say, to Lubbock and back. And that's it. Most of our routes aren't more than 10 hours, and some of them are even 6 or 7 hours, so it's not as bad as it seems, Tomlin said. They may make a few stops depending on the size of the city. The laundry started May 24, 2011. The building was constructed from the ground up as a laundry. Historically, services in the West Central Texas region were hard to come by. The services had to come a long way to provide them, and there weren't a lot of players in the laundry industry here in the West Texas area. The service that we did get was not great. They didn't do a great job. They were short a lot on products that were needed, or the delivery schedule was really challenging because it was so far away, or the hospitals did it in-house, which is the way they did it back in the day. Hospitals need to focus on health care, and so when they're trying to run a laundry with employees, with utilities, with machines, you're dedicating maintenance guys to making sure a towel folder is running, as opposed to doing something in a patient room. So it was more cost effective for hospitals, and still is, to outsource their linen service. Medical Center Hospital and Hendrick both shut down their in-house laundries to be able to start this, Tomlin said. Midland Memorial was already getting service, but it wasn't a great service, so all of them put their heads together and came up with this idea. I believe it's been a great partnership, he added. Last year, for the first time, they bought in a fourth owner, Shannon Medical Center. It's been the founding three members since its inception, and then 10 years later, we brought on a fourth owner, Tomlin said. There are several requirements for hospital linen. Between Joint Commission, OSHA, CDC, and nursing associations, there are high standards for linen, and they're getting more stringent almost on an annual basis. So having proper services is essential for quality patient care. Linens must be hygienically cleaned for patient use. What the hospitals do in their facilities typically is they may change the bedding out every day or as needed, often being soiled. But there are standards set at the hospital level. What we do is once they bag up the soiled linen, whenever they flip a room, for example, they'll put in the soiled linen and send it back to us in delivery carts. Tomlin said, we open up the bags and sort it out. We have a very technologically advanced system in our facility. A lot of things are more automated, state-of-the-art technology, so that we wash effectively and efficiently. A lot of people assume they use washers like you have at home. There are two tunnel washers, each with 8 150-pound modules, sections, per tunnel, and each module represents a different stage of the wash process. Loads of linen travel through each section of the tunnel so that by the end of the process, the linen load is clean. At any given moment, there's 2,400 pounds of linen being washed, and every 3 to 4 minutes, a 150-pound load exits the backside of the tunnel, goes into a press that presses the water out of the linen, and then onto a transport trolley that carries the load automatically to a 300-pound capacity dryer, Tomlin said. Then we have a sling transport system that transports it from the sort deck to the tunnel of a washer, then from the dryers on the backside to where the machines are for folding or ironing products, he added. The small washers he refers to are 150-pound industrial-strength single-unit washers. Tomlin said it would be more like what you would have at home, but on an industrial level. It's very effective and efficient. Those are for smaller loads, Tomlin said. All of the mass quantity goods go through our tunnel washers, but about 3% of what we do goes through our small wash process. He added that 98% of their linen is rental linen from a uniform service. We own the rental pool, and they just rent it from us. So a bedspread is a bedspread, whether it came from MCH and went to Odessa Regional or vice versa. It's all the same spread. Then they order what they need, say 300 sheets. They submit the order online and re-receive it. We fill the order and send it out the next day, Tomlin said. The building is still good. They've added equipment over the years, especially to help with the folding and ironing process. As we've added more customers, we've added more equipment so that we have the capacity to produce the required load, Tomlin said. Medical Center Chief Operating Officer Matt Collins said THL has been a great joint venture. This goes back quite some time, probably 12 plus years. There was a time when Medical Center had its own laundry. The equipment was becoming very aged. We did the cost analysis, and it would be very, very expensive to replace all of the equipment that's involved. So they started evaluating their options, Collins said. The three founding hospitals put in a certain amount of money to get it going, and it was wildly successful. It's extremely reliable. I can't remember a day that we've had trouble except for maybe one day during Snowmageddon. The trucks couldn't get to Abilene, but we still had enough emergency linen on site to be able to make it through a few days. We're very pleased with the quality of linen that comes out of the plant. Linen service very widely. They handle and manage replacement linen. THL does a good job with that, and we're very pleased financially. We're probably paying 75 cents to a dollar less a pound by doing this joint venture, Collins said. We have a board of directors, so the hospital gets a say in how the laundry is run and pricing. It works very, very well, Collins added.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.